way we have to live here in this country.
I think we're having a little bit of trouble with our audio tonight. Sometimes we do have a little bit. To apologize for the very yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on altrighttv.com or whiteresistanceradio.com. You can reach us through either venue. Well, lots more news and views for our people. And, of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European Heartland. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me. Well, lots of interesting things happening. this is from the National Post on Saturday, and that's the 25th, and rather disturbing letters to the editor. Apparently what had happened was that on the previous day, there had been a photo published in the National Post of, it looks like, six teenage girls, and they were at some place, they're at a concrete, sitting on a concrete barrier as they waited for a table at a bar at an outdoor patio in Ottawa's Byward Market. Now, these young girls, we can't see their faces, or only perhaps in profile. They'd be girls, I would say, in their late teens, early 20s, and they're all sitting on this concrete barrier. What's the problem? Well, I don't see a problem. They're not social distancing and they're not wearing masks. Well, Yeah, they're not wearing masks, but we're also told that outdoors there is much less likelihood of the spread of this coronavirus. They're just young kids being young people being young people.
Well, the vituperation of the letters to the editor, and there were three that were published, one from Vancouver, one from Georgian, Ontario, one from Stratford, Ontario. It was frightening to read the vehemence and the rage.
This is Larry Boswick from Stratford, Ontario. The photo of the six young females is dismaying and infuriating. It is a picture of the will of willful ignorance at best and a selfish, immature, and irresponsible mindset at worst. There's no evidence of their awareness of healthy practices as they are not wearing masks or social distancing, just a stark portrayal of disdain for the welfare of other people. I doubt that is what's going through these young ladies' minds. If through contact tracing or any of these girls or their like-minded peers are connected to another person's death, they should be charged with manslaughter. Why not just take them out and shoot them on the roadside without a trial? It is justifiable that they are publicly shamed through this photo. But the consequence needs to be stronger. When people are losing their lives due to the stupid actions of others, it is no different than killing someone by dangerous driving or careless handling of a weapon. Well, first of all, the foreseeable consequences of drunk or dangerous driving are fairly straightforward. The foreseeable consequences of careless handling of a weapon are also relatively predictable. We don't know, quite frankly, about the transmission. And that's the truth. We're told one thing one month, we're told another thing another month. I remember when our government was parroting the WHO, that's World Health Organization, and the Red Chinese Party line that the COVID virus was not transmissible from humans. That was the party line. Well, then that changed. The usefulness of masks changed. At first, we were told they didn't do much good, and besides, they socially stigmatized people, whatever that meant. And then now, in many cases, they're mandatory. I would say the foreseeable results of their actions are not very plain. We're also told that outdoor exposure, that there is relatively little danger in outdoor exposure. It might depend on what, if everybody is sweating and exchanging body fluids, it might be a little different. A little over a month ago, in the middle of latter part of May, we finally had some warm weather in Toronto, and a lot of people have been cooped up in their apartments, socially distancing for a long time, poured out into Trinity Bellwoods Park. There were about 10,000 people apparently in the park. And there were some instances where people were not more than 6 feet apart. And the scolding and outrage from the city politicians and others was really something to behold. Well, were there thousands of cases resulting from that? No. There was there was no spike at all. So much of what we're being warned about is at the very least highly questionable. But I must say I'm somewhat taken aback at the vehemence, the anger that this man would want these young women, if anybody dies because they passed on the COVID virus, they should be charged with manslaughter. I'm appalled. If anybody is responsible, it's the policymakers. These girls don't make policy. I'll tell you who did, who does. The Prime Minister of this country, the Chief Medical Officer of Health, the China woman, Dr. Theresa Tam, and our Minister of Health. She's the high-flying, much-traveled Patty Hajdu. In 1 month period when she was telling people to stay home, she went back and flew back to her riding in Thunder Bay four times. Let's see, and our Minister of Immigration.
I'll tell you why they bear responsibility. Because early on, when we knew this flu was a Wuhan flu coming from Red China, there were calls to close the border. Stop travel from Red China. The President of the United States did that. Our government never has. You know, they have limited it, to be fair. They have limited it. But it hasn't been stopped completely. So, if anybody who is responsible for the deaths of people is people like Justin Trudeau, Patty Hajdu, and Theresa Tam. And they said that to single out any one race, or in this case the Chinese, was to be, you got it, racist. So rather than be racist, let's not crack down on travel from the source of this flu. Those are the ones who bear responsibility. Anyway, Larry Boswick, Baswick, it's one more crack in. The feeble admonitions of angry mayors and premiers are ineffective. Those who refuse to comply with rules designed for the public good are outliers and must be dealt with accordingly. Do you hear the totalitarianism there? Garth M. Evans of Vancouver has something also to offer here. He says, I read recently that a new word has been added to the English language, corona asshole, meaning a person who refuses to wear a mask or practice social distancing. It applies to quite a few people around here. Notice again that the fury, the anger, the intolerance. And that is one of the results of cultural Marxism. That is coming to a head during this coronavirus or Wuhan flu crisis. And there's a further letter. This is from a Victoria Reed of Georgina, Ontario. Remember when you were kids and mom said, cover your mouth when you cough? But why, we'd ask? Because you're spreading germs. You make other people sick and it's impolite, she'd reply. It didn't matter who was president, your mom voted, or if it was a free country. And if you'd refused any of these, if you'd refused for any of those silly reasons, mom would have smacked some common sense into you with the back of her hand and said, I won't have people thinking any kid of mine was raised in a barn. Now, just for a while, we have to cover our mouths when we talk, because it's really easy to spread some pretty bad germs. So suck it up and put on a mask. You don't look like a freedom fighter or even a principled protester. You look like someone who was raised in a barn, says Victoria Reed. Well, I disagree. First of all, Mom, of course, was quite right. Cover your mouth when you cough to prevent the spread of germs. COVID virus, and that still applies. With COVID virus, you are urged to slap a handkerchief or Kleenex over your mouth if you can predict the cough or sneeze if it comes on too quickly. Put your arm up and cover your mouth. Now, nothing's changed, but the mask has. And I doubt that the mask is that effective in actually blocking the spread of particles from a cough. It's far more than that. Again, though, notice the absolute intolerance. The coronavirus. We scandal is the gift that just keeps on giving. Well, I'll explain why. First of all, just as a recap. We is a charity founded by two do-gooding brothers, Craig and Mark Kielberger, 25 years ago. A spin-off of that is Me to We,
which, although it sounds like a charity, is actually a for-profit business that supposedly funnels its most of its profits to charity. It sells things like necklaces and other things made by approved, fairly compensated, we're assured, labor in the third world. They also apparently have a resort in places like Kenya. And high flyers who are likely to give big bucks have been invited there, sometimes at entirely at the charity's expense. And now we're not talking about $100 a night room, or $200, which would be pretty luxurious in a third world country like Kenya. No, we're talking about units that, according to Rex Murphy of the National Post, go for $4,000 a night. Now, what you get for $4,000 a night is your... I leave it to your imagination. One of the fascinating things about this, though, is that the charity has done very, very well. In just 7 years, its real estate holdings have swollen from $13 million to $43 million, owned by a complex network of companies that all have something to do with we. But there's the We Foundation, and so on. It was actually a private land holding company owned by the Kielbergers that was going to receive $900,000 in, or dole out over $900,000 in grants for student volunteers until this whole project was aborted. The charity was going to make some $43 million out of administering the program. And there were many other problems. This is a government program, and you would think normally be administered by the government. Furthermore, it's all very mysterious as to why we would be chosen. There was no bidding for this contract. There is one of the Kielbergers said they got a call from the Prime Minister's office. We know we was actively lobbying government officials in April, just before the announcement. The Prime Minister says the civil service recommended we. There's considerable reason to be doubtful about this. The Kielbergers are very, very well connected. They appeared on Oprah. They are pals with the Clintons. They're high-flying charity entrepreneurs. And it appeared that they've done very, very well because of this. Well, tomorrow, Tuesday, there will be the opportunity for a parliamentary committee to question the Kielbergers. They're both going to appear before House of Commons Finance Committee. And here are some questions that Toronto Sun reporter Brian Lilly thinks ought to be asked of these charity hustlers. This is from his article in today's Toronto Sun. On Tuesday at noon, We Charity co-founders Craig and Mark Kielberger are set to testify about the story that has rocked the Trudeau government and one of Canada's biggest charities. MPs from all parties will get a chance to ask questions, but time will be tight. I decided to write up some of the questions that I would ask if I were able to take part in the discussions. And here are the questions. Who contacted whom about We Charity running a government program for youth during the pandemic, and when? At first, the government claimed that it was the civil service that picked We. Mark Kielberger claimed that the Trudeau's office contacted him and then quickly changed his tune when that got Trudeau in hot water. See, He seems he misremembered it, or so he said. Now, we're not talking about something that happened, 10 years ago. We submitted proposals to the government as early as April 9th. Now, let's get to the bottom of this. It would sound as though, and we was hustling the government for some sort of funding because, and this too is very mysterious, we had somehow broken an agreement it had with a bank. Now, what does that mean? They had not repaid a loan or not made prescribed payments on a mortgage? We don't know. Second question, which cabinet minister did we meet before getting this contract? And when did these meetings happen? House Leader Bardish Jagger, that's a woman, East Indian, has insisted there was the civil service who dreamt up this $912 million program, but failed to tell the committee last week that she'd met with Craig Kielberger on April the 17th, 5 days before the program was announced. Bill Mordaunt, he's the finance minister, had a phone call. Who else did they talk to? See, the we presence was all over Ottawa. At the highest levels, talking to cabinet ministers, who ended up very soon, although several like Trudeau, whose family received over $300,000 in speaking fees from we, and Mr. Morneau, who received over $41,000 in travel and accommodations that he'd sort of forgotten to repay. He did repay it last week, but. We was all over Ottawa at a time when they apparently needed money. Question number three, according to Brian Lilly, was there ever a quid pro quo with the Prime Minister on hiring his family? We's funding shot up dramatically after Justin Trudeau became Prime Minister, from $500,000 over a three-year period to $5 million over four. So the 3 years prior to 2015... during the Harper administration, we got a total of $500,000 total. During the first 3 years of the Trudeau regime, they got $5 million. At the same time, we began hiring the Prime Minister's mother, that's Margaret Trudeau, to speak at We Day events to the tune of $312,000 over 4 years, or an average of $78,000 per year. Many people for a full-time job being less than that. Did we do this to keep grants and contracts flowing? Was there ever a discussion of this with Trudeau? Question number four. Since we withdrew from the contract on July 3rd, have either Craig or Mark Kielberger, staff from we, or from me to we, or any of their representatives, spoken to or been in contact with the Prime Minister's office? Question number five. Why did we, a charity most people associate with helping people in the poorest parts of the world, go from $10.8 million in real estate holdings in 2013 to $43.7 million in 2018? Does the charity really need a whole block in Toronto? Is there a condo redevelopment plan going on? Question number six. How many other MPs and cabinet ministers have taken free trips from we to me or from we? As I say, closely affiliated, and please name them. Question number seven. How much revenue did Me to We generate last year? This is a business that makes a ton of money because it is associated with a charity. It sells the products and trips based on the premise that it's helping a charity. They even use similar branding. Reports claim Me to We earned $47 million last year. Is that accurate? Question number eight. Was the board fired or did they resign? This is an important question for the Kielbergers and Michelle Douglas to answer. She was the former chairman of the board of We Canada, who says she resigned. She was not forced out, but resigned because of certain concerning matters, whatever that means. I don't like that the concerning uses an adjective, but that's what she said. And she's going to be testifying tomorrow, truly. I'm not being sarcastic. I can hardly wait. Question number nine. There's a recording of a phone call where Mark Kielberger listens as a former and now former employee describes bribing Kenyan officials and having difficulty in getting them to take the money. Has we, or me to we, or their employees or representatives ever bribed officials in another country? Because, you know, that's illegal. Question number 10. 9 different properties in Kenya were transferred from WE's charitable operations in that country to a private company called WE Education for Children Limited. Can you tell us why you did that? Will WE provide the names of the people who control the private company now holding land purchased with charitable donations? And finally, how much real estate does WE, or me to WE, own outside of Canada? If we can get answers to these questions, the country will have a clearer understanding of what's been going on with this contract the past few months and this charity for the past several years. Those are extremely good questions. Let's hope that some of the MPs ask them. The Kielbergers, and I've had my eye on them for a long time, are charity hustlers. And they harness the idealism of young, usually high school students who get together and hear speakers in a rally, and it's almost like a semi-religious cult. most of these young people are idealistic, hoping to do some good. Is this idealism being harnessed for less than admirable purposes? And this is a column in today's Toronto Sun by Sabrina Zuniga. The spotlight on the WE organizations through the student so-called volunteer program the Liberal government tried to install has pulled back the curtain on this collection of organizations and caused many to ask what benefit it is to our students. Our public schools are mandated to provide students with some kind of personal empowerment or enrichment programming, and the WE organizations seem to fit. So principals could check off that box and the long list of things they must ensure happen in the schools. However, WE Day is a show. It's a huge production with fancy staging, elaborate lighting, slick videos, and celebrity speakers and performers, all with the goal of getting the students to raise money for WE organizations. It's a hustle. This is supposed to make students feel empowered and that they are saving the world and make them feel that they are quite literally saving the children of Africa. Put aside problem with the exploitation of the goodwill of our kids by using them to raise money for WE to buy real estate in Toronto and consider the mental impact on our students. The programming takes students, adolescents living through a time period in their lives when they're trying to figure out who they are and where they fit in, and tells them that dealing with all that is not enough. They must also save the world. This is tone deaf. This reflects the privilege from whence the founders, that's the Kielbergers, the Kielberger brothers, grew up. consider also that in many schools, teachers are encouraged to find students to attend WE days who may be quieter and marginalized. In other words, don't just recruit the student council. This sounds nice on paper, but in practice, these students often are part of low-income families. With WE Day, they are taken away from classes for one day or more and told how they need to donate food or raise money. Yet these kids need food themselves and may work after or before school to make money for the family. How does WE empower them? When it comes to community service, it's always good to have students think of the bigger world and understand how their actions can have a greater effect. But too often, external school-wide efforts shun or ignore serious issues closer to home. We praise and hold up as examples those students who lead a charitable activity. But what about the student who's quietly hungry all day? That student is now pressured to donate something he or she doesn't have or feel guilty about not being able to donate. How is that student empowerment? How does that build self-esteem? In doing community service to get students out of their own heads and feeling good helping others, the activity should be something that anyone can participate in, regardless of the financial situation. Things like reading to lower grades, doing crafts with a seniors home, singing to veterans, or reading to dogs in a shelter. I think this is a really interesting column. Sabrina Zuniga is a PhD. She's an entrepreneur and strategic analyst who specializes in political and social issues. She's a former educator and a founder of the think tank Truth and Consequences. Some very good questions about me to we, and about basically using a relatively captive student audience to hustle hustle money for charities who seem to spend a good deal of that money on real estate acquisitions and property acquisitions in Kenya and in Canada. Some very important questions, and you know, if they weren't into the public purse, you know, what the WE does as a charity, or you might say, well, that's their business. But they are into the public purse. And they very nearly got themselves one awfully sweet, lucrative contract. Many of you with long memories may remember a movie called The Graduate. It came out in 1967. It's hard to believe it's over 50 years ago. And this is a very interesting column article from the Occidental Observer from today. And it's in the Jewish themes in The Graduate, the movie, which kind of be Dustin Hoffman his start. The 1967 film The Graduate was a landmark in Jewish cultural subversion. By the time of this film's release, Jewish filmmakers in Hollywood were becoming more explicit in their antipathy for white Americans and their culture, and this was increasingly reflected in their output. In 1963, the Jewish producer Larry Terman came across the 24-year-old Californian Charles Webb's novel, *The Graduate*, which he claimed had an emotional coloration for me, like the Jewish playwright Harold Pinter. The book was funny, but it made you nervous at the same time. In his novel, Webb looks back in anger at his gilded California lifestyle as the son of a Pasadena cardiologist. His semi-autobiographical protagonist, Benjamin Braddock, a 20-year-old recent graduate from an East Coast university, returns to his California home for a long, hot summer, over the course of which he stumbles into a passionless affair with the much older Mrs. Robinson, the wife of his father's business partner. Braddock becomes infatuated with Mrs. Robinson's daughter, Elaine, who reciprocates his feelings but rebuffs him after learning of his relationship with his mother. Mrs. Robinson sends Elaine off to college at UC Berkeley, where she becomes engaged to her classmate, Carl Smith. A desperate Benjamin crashes their wedding and elopes with Elaine, to the great distress of her family. Terman bought the rights to the book for $1,000 and sent it unsolicited to Jewish director Mike Nichols, born Mikhail Peshkowski. Why did they just so many of them change their names? Who signed on to the project. Terman's search for financing led his film to Jewish film mogul Joseph E. Levine, the Schlockmeister of the world, who put up $3 million. Terman's impulse purchase of the rights led to one of the most consequential films ever. Released in December 1967, The Graduate grossed almost $105 million, equivalent to about $1 billion today, the third highest ever at the time, and was nominated for 7 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and acting nods for stars Anne Bancroft, Mrs. Robinson, Dustin Hoffman, and Catherine Ross. Catherine was the love interest. Plus an Oscar victory for director Nichols. The Graduate has since become one of the most referenced films in the popular cultural lexicon of the Western world. Nichols assigned Jewish screenwriter Buck Henry, born Henry Zuckerman, again, why do they always change their names? Then writing for the TV spy spoof Get Smart as a screenwriter. Henry ended up sharing writing credits with the non-Jewish Calder Willingham, who had written a rejected first script, songs by Jewish duo Simon and Garfunkel, including Mrs. Robinson, the song, were used for the soundtrack. Given the many Jews involved in the film's production, it's hardly surprising that Jewish sensibilities and ideological fixations pervaded the final product. The Graduate was not meant to read Jewish in the novel. The non-Jewish Charles Webb wrote the 1963 novel when he was just out of Williams College, which at the time is alleged to have been notoriously anti-Semitic, even at the administrative level. In the hands of director Mike Nichols, however, the story became a scathing critique of bourgeois white Anglo-Saxon Protestant American culture and the oppressive burden it purportedly imposed on young Americans. Nichols employs two recurrent visual metaphors to symbolize this supposedly oppressive culture: black and white stripes and water. The former representing prison bars confining Benjamin, while the latter, the numerous scenes referencing pools, aquariums, scuba diving, and rain, are said to symbolize the oppressive weight of societal expectation. The troubled water theme recurs throughout the film, with Benjamin floundering in a toxic social order where he's submerged underwater trap, his world appearing claustrophobically enclosed like a fish in a small tank of water. The film resonated with a generation of young people concerned, as recent college graduate Benjamin Braddock is, about their place in the adult world they were reluctantly entering. Beverly Gray, the author of the 2017 book Seduced by Mrs. Robinson, How the Graduate Became the Touchstone of a Generation, claims the film, quote, strikes me as having a Jewish soul. Laurie Shapiro, who of course is Jewish, writing for The Forward, which is a Jewish publication, agrees, observing that despite the all-American storyline of the novel, The Graduate, the film version, has always signaled a very Jewish sensibility to me, starting with Dustin Hoffman, oddly cast in the lead of super waspy Connecticut kid Benjamin Braddock, referring to its Jewish director Mike Nichols. Notes how the film seems to me Jewish in a social sense, in terms of the Jewish outsider, which is certainly the way Mike Nichols viewed himself. Nichols was feeling a bit askew among the comforts of bourgeois America. It's important to remember that Nichols, as a very young refugee from National Socialist Germany, was a refugee. He never really got over the experience of fleeing Berlin at age 7. I go on to add that Nichols has made the following comment. Dustin has always said that Benjamin is a walking surfboard, and that's what he was in the book, in the original conception. But I kept looking and looking for an actor until I found Dustin, who was the opposite, who's a short, dark, Jewish, anomalous presence, which is how I experienced myself. So in other words, the character in the movie is actually a Jewish, unimpressive, neurotic person, unlike the tall Anglo-Saxon in the book. It's a provocative statement because Nichols was neither short nor dark, though clearly he felt a strong inner discomfort about the way he presented himself to the world. He certainly identified with the angst felt by Benjamin Braddock in the movie and the novel. The perennial theme of Jewish alienation from a WASP-dominated mainstream American society played an important role in how the character of Benjamin Braddock and the entire film were conceived by Nichols, though this only became apparent to him after the film had been made. My unconscious was making this movie, Nichols later recalled. It took me years before I got what I had been doing all along, that I was turning Benjamin into a Jew. I didn't get it until I saw this hilarious issue of Mad Magazine about after the movie came out, in which the character of Dustin says to the mother of Elizabeth Wilson, Mom, how come I'm Jewish and you and Dad aren't? And I asked myself the same question. And the answer was fairly embarrassing and fairly obvious. Who was the Jew among the Goyim? This is a quote, this is not. And who is forever a visitor in a strange land? It was with his Cassie and Benjamin Braddock, described in the book as a tall, blonde, and athletic, that Nichols took his biggest risk. Unable to resist the urge to engage in Jewish ethnic networking, he passed over Robert Redford for an unheralded, diminutive 29-year-old Jew, Dustin Hoffman. Nichols cast Hoffman, despite the fact that he was virtually unknown and looked nothing like the leading man described in the script, which called for a tall, blonde track star, not a short Jewish guy with a schnoz for the ages. This is what he says. This is not a commentary. Hoffman later recalled telling Nichols, "The character is 5'11", a track star. It feels like this is a dirty trick, sir." The director replied, "You mean you're Jewish? That's why you don't think you're right. Maybe he's Jewish inside." Nichols claimed that casting Dustin Hoffman emphasized Benjamin's alienation from the WASP middle-class world around him and its oppressive expectations. Well, the Jewish director Steven Soderbergh, Nichols' choice was the seminal event in the defining of motion picture leading men in the last 50 years. A number of early reviews of The Graduate described Hoffman as ugly. An article in Life magazine referred to him as a swarthy Pinocchio and made humorous references to his prominent nose. According to Gray, however, what was important was the way young audiences embraced Hoffman, big nose and all. Suddenly it was okay not to look like Robert Redford and still play a romantic leading role. Hoffman's anti-heroic character gave the green light for Hollywood to promote the ethnic Jewish matinee idol and youth icon in the form of George Segal, Elliot Gould, Richard Benjamin, Charles Grodin, and Gene Wilder. These Jewish romantic leads were invariably paired on screen with beautiful non-Jewish actresses like Marsha Mason, Candace Bergen, and in the case of Dustin Hoffman, blondes like Mia Farrow, Faye Dunaway, Susan George, and Meryl Streep. The new era was a boon for Jewish actors who, as Gray points out, suddenly no longer had to fret about not resembling the WASP ideal. Nor did they need to hide such stars as John Garfield and Kirk Douglas had done behind anglicized names. The casting of Dustin Hoffman as the graduate's leading man was a shock to Hollywood, which had spent decades trying to sidestep the Judaic roots of its founders. But in the wake of The Graduate, young Jewish males were suddenly everywhere, and often they were playing characters with backgrounds similar to their own. This was the era that launched Richard Benjamin in Goodbye Columbus, 1969, and Richard Dreyfuss in The Goodbye Girl, 1977, along with Grodin. It was all part of what critic Jay Hoberman, paying tribute to Elliot Gould in The Village Voice, wittily called the Jew Wave. Not the New Wave, but the Jew Wave. I'll continue this on a later program, but I found this commentary in the Occidental Observer to be absolutely first rate and very, very powerful. Well, this is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side of me here on altrighttv.com or whiteresistanceradio.com. And I'm going to play from a concert with George Jones, of course, called the Possum, and in his earlier heavy...
If you're tired of reading about other...
Heavy drinking days, sometimes called no-show Jones, George Jones.
I guess the thing that impressed me more about George Jones was just a good old guy when I met him. If you didn't know him, you'd think he worked at the gas station down the road. I'm Alan Jackson. George Jones, legend, singer. What could I say about him? And already been said 1,000 times, and all of it's true. To meet somebody like that and still realize they're just a good old human being and they just love to sing, and that's what George does, and he sings better than anybody. I can't think of anything that can say any more than his songs and music has said for the last 30 years. So I think we ought to just...
Don't rock the jukebox, I want to hear George Jones.
To our video tonight and to our great big show, and we're gonna have a great big time. I can see that already. We love you. Here we go.
Hey George, did you know Waylon and old Willie are the outlaws?
I didn't know that at all. So.
You know Roger was the king on the road. You got it, possum.
You've had all your love.
Oh my goodness. Y'all are something else tonight in Oxford. Bless your heart. Great. We just want you to know that we love you as usual, and we just hope that you'll have a great big time on our behalf tonight. I'll tell you what, we're going to have a big one. And I just want to know one thing right now, before we get too far along in the show. Are you ready to get on with it tonight? Well, I feel dear well enough for a new thing. From going all lost, kept little George to keep from slipping away.
That's the late great George Jones. Sign off tonight, as I always do. The anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on altrighttv.com or whiteresistanceradio.com. This is Paul Fromm, and I sign off tonight with the Maple Leaf Forever. And perhaps with just a little bit of a lag here. You have to apologize for the very slow internet connection here. This is Paul Fromm, and